This is a truncated fundraising version of Behind the News. The last 20 minutes of the program are devoted to fundraising for KPFA. I don't want to make you listen to 20 minutes of fundraising, but I will say this. KPFA is what makes this broadcast possible if you listen to it on the web or on a podcast. And if you like what you hear and want to keep it coming, please consider supporting KPFA. You can do that by calling 510-848-5732. 510-848-5732, or visiting kpfa.org on the web, where you can make a secure pledge. Look for the Behind the News premiums if you like. These are Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin's The Making of Global Capitalism, their story of the creation of the U.S. Empire, Matt Kennard's book Irregular Army on how desperation for bodies led the army to lower its recruiting standards dramatically, bringing in neo-Nazis and criminals and very sad and damaged people with possibly very severe consequences in the years ahead. There's also a CD containing MP3s with the best of Behind the News, about 18, 20 hours of programming, about 20 interviews I've done over the years. And then finally, David K. Johnston's book, The Fine Print, which is all about how corporate America rips us off. Those premiums and many others available at kpfa.org. So if you like what you hear, please consider making that contribution. And if you make that contribution, please mention Behind the News. Thanks. Now here's the first 32 minutes or so of the show, shorn of the 20 final minutes of fundraising. Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today is a special fundraiser edition featuring a new book just out from Verso by Matt Kennard, a young British journalist, about all the scary people, neo-Nazis, gang members, criminals, and the sick and the desperate, who've been joining the army, getting training, and stealing weapons. It's called Irregular Army, and you can get a copy of the hardcover for a pledge of $100 to KPFA. More details on that to come. Before all that, just a few comments on Wednesday's presidential debate. I should say that while I am not a Democrat, and never had much hope invested in the candidate of hope from 2008, I do think we'd be marginally better off if Obama won. One reason we'd be better off is that when a Democrat is in power, it's easier to see that the problems with our politics, the dominance of money and state violence, are systemic issues and not just a matter of individuals or parties. That's not to say there are no differences between the two major parties. Republicans are a gang of terrifying reactionaries. But the problems of the Dems help explain what is almost universally regarded as Obama's dismal performance in the first debate. First, Obama's personality. In an earlier life, I spent a lot of time studying the psychoanalytic literature on narcissism. It was all part of a study of canonical American poetry, where I thought that the imperial grandiosity of the American imaginary could be illuminated by examining an underlying narcissism. But all that is by way of saying that I'm not using this term recklessly. I think there's a lot of the narcissist about Obama. There's something chilly and empty about him. Unlike Bill Clinton, he doesn't revel in human company. It makes him uncomfortable. He wants the rich and powerful to love him, but he doesn't care about the masses. They bore him, and it shows. Which is not unrelated to a more political problem. Unlike Franklin Roosevelt, who famously said that he welcomed the hatred of the rich, Obama wants to flatter them. He once made the mistake of calling them fat cats, so his former Wall Street fans turned at him. That has something to do with why he didn't mention the 47% thing on Wednesday, or Tara Romney as the candidate of the 0.1%. That would be divisive and offend the people whose love he craves. FDR came out of the aristocracy and had the confidence to step on the fancy toes of the rich now and then. Obama came out of nowhere, was groomed for success by elite institutions throughout his splendid rise, and wants some of those nice shoes for himself. More broadly, the political problem of the Democrats is that they're a party of capital that has to pretend for electoral reasons sometimes that it's not. All the complaints that liberals have about them, their weakness, tendency to compromise, the constantly lamented lack of a spine, emerge from this central contradiction. The Republicans have a coherent philosophy and use it to fire up a rabid base. The Dems are afraid of their base because it might cause them trouble with their funders. What do liberals stand for these days? Damned if I know. It's not a philosophy you can express in aphorisms. Yeah, politics are complex and slogans are simple, but if you've got a passionately held set of beliefs, you can manage that contradiction eloquently. But liberals suffer from too many qualifications and contradictions. They can't just say less war and more equality because they like some wars and want to bore you with just war theory to explain the morality of drone attacks. And they worry about optimal tax rates and proper incentives. Join an empty philosophy to an empty personality and you get a very flat and meandering performance in debate. Most liberals want to write off Obama's bad performance as a bad night. It's not just that. It's a structural problem. Okay, now on to Matt Kennard. Kennard is a young British journalist who is no stranger to the U.S. He's just out with a book called Irregular Army, How the U.S. Military Recruited Neo-Nazis, Gang Members, and Criminals to Fight the War on Terror, from Verso. You'll be able to get it for a pledge of $100 to KPFA. Details on that after we listen to about 26 minutes of Matt Kennard. Welcome, Matt. How did you come to write a book about the U.S. Army, particularly the troubled U.S. Army?
I arrived in the States in 2007 to do a master's, and it was in a master's in investigative journalism. And at the time, it was public knowledge that the U.S. military was having problem recruiting soldiers. They were being public about certain groups that they were allowing in, so they raised the enlistment age from 35 to 40, then to 42. They started letting people in with low IQ, etc. So this was being written about in the media at the time. So I sort of thought, well, I was thinking about a project to do at Columbia. What about the groups that are much more controversial that they're not telling us about? So I thought, I already had a history of looking at the far right in the UK. I'd exposed a professor at my university in the UK and he was eventually sacked. I exposed him as a racist. So I had that background. And it took only a couple of weeks of doing some preliminary reporting and talking to far-right leaders and some extremist veterans to find out that they were operating basically an open-door policy. So having done that preliminary research, I just took that on over the next year and basically interviewed pretty much every major player in the far-right movement in the US and a bunch of extremist veterans as well. That then got published in Salon.com in 2009. It was basically the first article in the mainstream media on the topic. After that, I was approached to write a book, which eventually became Irregular Army, filling in the blanks of the other groups. So groups from gang members to hardened criminals, and then ironically to gay people who enjoyed a renaissance under the Bush administration that was counterintuitive.
Let's go through the rogues gallery. Of course, I guess perhaps the most shocking would be the nest of far-rightists. Mm. And these are not people just with merely conservative politics, right?
No. Yeah. No, these are people that, I mean, they're as extreme as you can get in terms of white supremacists. I mean, I don't really like to draw a distinction between the far-right movement because you don't want to let anyone off the hook, but the ones I'm talking about in the book are really even to the right of the white supremacist movement. The neo-Nazis, the hardcore, violent individuals that basically see their role in US society as trying to ignite what they call Rahe, which is a racial holy war, which will pit all races against each other and then into open revolt with the corrupt government, which they call Zog, which means Zionist occupation government, an updated Jewish conspiracy theory. So they don't see it as a way to spread freedom and democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, they didn't see it as a way to spread freedom and democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan. They saw it as a way to acquire weapons, training, and tactical skills which they can bring back to the US. And I mean, we've seen examples of that. I covered the war on terror during my investigations covered the war on terror period. But I mean, you had the Sikh Temple massacre recently, where a neo-Nazi veteran of the 1990s had carried out a massacre of what he believed, I suspect, were Muslims, but were actually Sikhs.
Parenthetically, since you have experience in the British far right, any similarities or differences between the US and Britain?
Well, it's just interesting because there's just been a book published by Verso as well on the British far right by a journalist called Daniel Trilling. And I'd say that the people he's writing about are much more mainstream. There's been a current in the UK far right movement where they've basically shorn off, I mean, they're still virulent racists, but they've shorn off the jagged edges. They've come from a sort of street movement into the political mainstream, and their leader, Nick Griffin, is now a member of the European Parliament. He got enough votes to have a seat in the European Parliament. So they're much, the people I'm looking at in the US are much more marginal. I mean, they do have political parties, but they're political parties like the National Socialist Movement. I mean, which has no, is not any kind of mainstream force. And I mean, in the US, you have a Republican Party and a Tea Party, which takes over some of the terrain of the white supremacists, which we don't. I mean, the Conservative Party in the UK used to be pretty racist, but they've had to change their ways now, and they have black politicians in prominent positions, whereas the Republicans, I think, especially in parts of the South, have taken some of the ground away from people like the KKK and other far-right groups.
Yes, it's now almost a purely white party.
Yeah, exactly.
Getting back to the far-rightists you talked to are not well-liked by the police, right? The FBI is on their case.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing that I came across when I was looking into it, is that during the War on Terror, you saw this massive sort of ruction happen between the FBI and the GAO and other federal investigative bodies and the Army's own investigative unit called CID, which is short for Criminal Investigative Command. So CID were basically victims of the thesis of the book, which is that the US could no longer afford to kick people out, which they had people they would have kicked out before because they were scrambling for troops. So CID were carrying out investigations which should have resulted in the discharge of various soldiers, but they were stopped doing it. And the FBI, on the other hand, didn't have that same priority. So they were investigating these soldiers and saying to CID, look, you can't let these people stay in the US military. This is going to be dangerous for the domestic population. And then CID would basically come back and say, this isn't a problem. So you ended up having this sort of fight happen. And you saw it across the white supremacist problem and the gang problem. It's not something that people ask much about, but in terms of numbers, the number of street gangs operating in the US military is actually more serious in terms of numbers than the white supremacists. A lot of analysts say that 10% of the US military is now composed of street gangs. And I mean, if you talk to soldiers, non-extremist, non-gang member soldiers, they'll tell you that they're open about their affiliations in the war zone and also on domestic bases. I mean, in the book, you have there's countless pictures of these gang members putting up their tags on basketballs in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, it's completely, they do it with impunity. Now, what this means for, well, I mean, what it meant for the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, we'll probably never know, because most of the atrocities that happened out there we don't know about, but we can get clues as to what they were doing out there from what they do back in the States. And during the War on Terror period, there's been countless examples of active duty personnel and veterans, especially along the border with Mexico at Fort Hood and Fort Bliss, the main bases in Texas, being involved in murders, assaults and trafficking weapons and drugs across the border, because in many ways soldiers are the job of being a soldier is great for a criminal, because you're not party to, you're not a victim of the normal law enforcement in normal society. You have specialized law enforcement which looks at you like CID, and also you move around, you have a relative degree of impunity which a regular citizen won't have. So because of that, white supremacists groups and gangs actively try and recruit soldiers. And I mean, you see it. You see these people setting up stalls, etc., on the edge of bases. It's quite prevalent.
Now, we sort of blew past this, but let's dwell on it for a moment. The problem for the Army's point of view was that it was getting harder and harder to get recruits. The war was ugly, and at least in 2006 or so, the economy is in reasonably decent shape, right?
Mm.
So
yep.
This is they're desperate for bodies.
Yep. There's a confluence of different factors. I mean, another major factor which isn't talked about a lot is Donald Rumsfeld had this vision of transforming the Pentagon. He believed that having wars with large amounts of ground troops was an anachronism from the Cold War, and that now, at the end of the Cold War, the US could basically go in with a couple of thousand special forces, which they did in Afghanistan, take out the regime pretty fast and then get out within a couple of years. And the war planning for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan both had that sort of Rumsfeldian vision in mind. Now, obviously, we know that was completely ridiculous, and it didn't happen like that at all. So you had, not only was were they scrambling for troops because they had to populate the both occupations, but they were in no way prepared for it. The war planning which US Central Command carried out before the war in Iraq had called for sort of 300,000 troops, and Rumsfeld got them down to half that. And
he wanted even less, right?
He wanted literally 50,000 or less. And then there was this famous war within a war where Eric Shinseki, who was the chief of the army, basically came out in open revolt against Rumsfeld and said, look, this is going to be ridiculous. And then also you had the whole Paul Bremer, the first viceroy in Iraq, decommissioning the police and the security services. So you had no indigenous capacity for law enforcement or military, plus the fact that the occupation didn't have enough troops, even in the planning. I mean, the planning from 1998, which was the first, which was the war planning, most recent war planning before the war in Iraq took place, called for 375,000 troops, and we got a third of that. So you had that. You also had the fact that in any other time there would have been conscription. I mean, everyone. I mean, it entered the debate quite prominently in 2006. Charlie Rangel put a bill in the House, which was defeated, and Bush said he would have vetoed it even if it had gone through, which called for conscription, and everyone was talking about it because. But the reason the Bush administration didn't do it was because they knew it would be the straw that broke the camel's back, because the Iraq War was hugely unpopular. If they'd conscripted the nation's youth, it probably would have brought it to an end much sooner, as you saw in Vietnam. I mean, the conscription caused a lot of outcry because it conscripted people that normally wouldn't serve. I mean, the middle classes, although a lot of them managed to escape it, some of them had to go.
They had to work hard to do it, though.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm speaking with Matt Kennard, who is author of Irregular Army, just out from Verso. And, of course, Rumsfeld seemed influenced by a lot of corporate thinking at the time, which was keep your commitments very light, outsource everything possible, and rely on fancy capital equipment, and you don't really need that many people, right?
Well, that was another part of the plan I was talking about. What was eventually called transformation was that operational tasks would be carried out by private contractors, which you saw. But I mean, by 2006, I think there were more private contractors in Iraq than there were U.S. Military personnel. Iraq, the failures in Iraq and as we're seeing in Afghanistan, I mean, Rumsfeld has to take a lot of blame for what happened. And people don't often talk about him anymore, but his vision, which was completely ill-suited to Iraq and Afghanistan, he's an ideologue, and he didn't look at the practicalities of the country or the local situations. He just wanted to impose this new vision without thinking about. And a lot of the disasters and the atrocities and the general traumatization of those societies has their root in his initial vision. The focus, I often get asked about the neo-Nazis and gangs sometimes, but there's a bunch of other groups that were enfranchised by the fact that they couldn't recruit enough. And often, and as you saw in Vietnam, it was often the poorest ethnic minorities which were enlisted in. I mean, there was a massive militarization of schools during the War on Terror, which happens to this day.
Yeah, I want to touch on all these things in a bit. But they get into the war for a couple of years and they find out that they need more people than they thought, right?
Yeah.
So they're desperate. They've called in the National Guard and then really loosen the recruiting standards.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But before we leave the topic of the far right, what's in it for them?
Well, it's quite simple. They, as I said earlier, they have this vision of launching a domestic insurgency against the corrupt government, and obviously training in weapons and skills and war skills is a boon for that purpose.
And they even steal equipment, right?
Yeah, well, there's countless examples. I mean, what's great about, I mean, not, well, it is great. I mean, the US is an open society, and they have a lot of great institutions doing work investigating these things, like the Government Accountability Office, GAO, and the FBI were actually quite good on issues to do with the Irregular Army, and they were looking into it, and they found countless examples of soldiers mailing back submachine guns to the US from Iraq and Afghanistan.
And I imagine the gang members have similar interests.
Yeah, and I mean, I was interviewing veterans who were saying their units were riven with gang members, who said that they heard them planning to sell heroin that they got in Afghanistan back in the States, etc. I mean, it was just rampant. And I mean, it's important to make the point that they weren't at all targeted by the military. In fact, the military targeted the whistleblowers. So there's...
Yeah, there are several stories in the book of people who tried to drop a dime on the bad guys and ended up getting punished for it.
Yeah, and I mean, you see that. I mean, that's not just a pattern with people who are raising alarm about gang members and neo-Nazis. It's also a pattern with people who are raising alarm about atrocities. I mean, I look into...
Now, these gang members are not just people with a taste for flashy clothes and funny tattoos, right? They're really rather dangerous folks.
Yeah, they're really dangerous. And I mean, they're really dangerous. They're now back in the States with these skills. And I mean, they're carrying out a lot of atrocities in the States, but we don't often hear about it because it's often inter-gang violence. So
you mentioned earlier that the guy who did the Sikh temple massacre was an early 90s veteran.
Yeah.
So these problems will ripple for years to come. Right?
Yeah, well, that's the point. And the scary thing that I make this point about the Sikh temple massacre, which isn't said enough, is that he was serving in the 1990s when when it's commonly assumed that the US military were hard on these types of people, because you had Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber. You also had this case of an active duty paratrooper called James Burmeister, who killed an African-American couple in the town next to Fort Bragg in 1995. So you had a certain amount of public outcry after that. Basically, the US population was saying, how can you be using our taxpayers' money to arm and train these crazy people that are attacking Americans? But then in the case of Wade Page, he was serving all through that period and after. And there was an article in Stars and Stripes, the military journal, in the aftermath of the Sikh Temple massacre, which said they interviewed various people that had served with Wade Page. And these people said Wade Page was completely open about his white supremacism while serving in the 1990s. So, I mean, if they were ignoring the problem then, it really boggles the mind to think what was happening in the war on terror, because even the thin regulations which did exist, and they are thin, and they are basically completely ambiguous and can be interpreted any way by a commander, they were completely bent during the war on terror in the interest of keeping troop levels up. And as you say, Wade Page, it took over a decade for him to really explode in the way that you would probably predict he would if you'd allow a white supremacist to serve in the PSYOPs, which is quite an elite part of the army. They're not going to go home and become vicars. They're going to probably want to use this. So it's the same sort of thing with, as you say, I mean, in the coming decades, there's this idea now that the war's going to come home. I talked to a Bloomberg journalist last week who said he's thinking about writing a book called The War Came Home, which is about what are all these people, all these undesirables that were serving out there, and what are they doing now they're back in the US? And it is really scary. And I mean,
they've got training and they've been like damaged psychologically.
Exactly. Well, that's it. It's a toxic mix, because you also have a confluence of factors. It's not just rampant racism or violent extremism. It's also the fact that, as you say, there's vast amounts of people that have PTSD that were untreated or misdiagnosed because the military couldn't afford to treat them. You also have the financial crisis, which is linking into this. So if a veteran gets foreclosed on by a bank, he hasn't been treated for his PTSD, and he's been solicited by a neo-Nazi group or something. I mean, they're going to blow their top. I mean, Wade Page is a good example. He was foreclosed on in a couple of months before he carried out the massacre. So this toxic mix is really a powder keg waiting to blow, in my opinion. And we'll see. And you see, another point that must be made is that you see it all the time on a small scale, right? I mean, if you look in the local papers, you'll find veterans doing awful things every day, but you just don't hear about it because it doesn't impact on the general. They're mostly, they'll kill their, I mean, there was...
Yeah, well, there was treason of isolated cases.
Yeah, and there was one recently where a veteran killed his wife and kids. But, I mean, they didn't get that much play, but small-scale incidents happen all the time. I mean, Wade Page was an outlier because he killed a lot of people, and it was an ideologically motivated attack, and it was outsiders. But people killing their wives and killing themselves, I mean, so we can get onto suicide later, but suicides of veterans is mind-boggling right now, the figures.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the violent people, the real agenda, like the gang members and the neo-Nazis, they're also, they brought in a lot of people who just had serious psychological problems or not up to it intellectually, had criminal records. I mean, these are really damaged people who are brought into the military in large numbers.
Yeah, and the effect of that is, I mean, it takes some investigative work, because the U.S. military tries to cut their initial reaction whenever anything happens that is bad is deny, deny, deny. But I mean, I talk about the Mamoudzou massacre in the book, where a unit of troops raped a 14-year-old girl, then murdered her and her family. And initially they said that was the work of insurgents. They burnt down a house as well. Initially they said that was the work of insurgents. The military believed it, or wanted to believe it. And it was one soldier who raised the alarm. Eventually, a couple of months later, the military initially targeted him, but he eventually got the word out and those soldiers got convicted. But anyway, the guy that was leading that group of soldiers that raped the girl, he had got into the military on what they call a moral waiver, which is a waiver they give to people with felony convictions or other persistent criminals. So he had only got into the military because they were so desperate for troops and had given him this moral waiver. So you see that pattern all the time. In fact, if you look closely at all the famous or infamous atrocities during the War on Terror, you can link them quite explicitly to the opening up of the US military or the drop in standards. I mean, Abu Ghraib's another example that was carried out by drunk soldiers in a way that the US military, although It has its problems. Compared to other modern militaries like the UK, etc., its policies on alcohol and drugs have been pretty strict. But during the war on terror, that was thrown out as well. I mean, that people were drinking openly. It was like a frat party at Abu Ghraib, and that. So you can go through each one and sort of link a lot of the awful stuff that happened out there to the loosening of standards.
And there also you mentioned a lot of horrific racist attitude towards Arabs.
Yeah.
The Haji is their term of abuse. Right?
Exactly. Yeah, and I mean that was endemic. And it came from the brass as well. That's the point.
It was encouraged by the leadership.
Exactly. And it's often the media narrative when something happens where, say, a racist soldier will kill an Iraqi or something, will be like, oh, this crazy individual, he was an outlier. This is nothing to do with the US military. And they'll put him out. They'll hang him out to dry. But that's to avoid the fact that this was endemic and it came from the brass. I mean, as you say, the word Hajis, which is like the N-word in the US and the UK, a really racist, horrible word.
You quote, like, a senior general.
So. Exactly. I was going to say General George Casey he denied it. I asked his spokesman, and his spokesman said he denied it, but he would say that, right? Anyway, this soldier said he heard him refer to Iraqis on multiple occasions as Hajis. And that doesn't surprise me. War is like that. And another outgrowth of the Rumsfeld ideology for the US military was that he had this idea that US military should not leave, or the soldiers should not leave their bases and interact with the local population. It was called the antibody theory, that if you put a US soldier in an Iraqi town, it would act like a virus and all the antibodies of the Iraqis would come and it would anger the Iraqi population. So the idea was that created this fortress mentality where the soldiers would just stay on the base and the Iraqi or the Afghani populations would then quite naturally be seen as outsiders or a subject population or subhuman, and it sort of engendered this fortress mentality amongst US soldiers. And I mean,
Killing people doesn't come naturally to most humans, so they do have to be encouraged.
Oh, the killing's a different thing, but the generalized racial racist.
Yeah, I mean, that racial characterization is part of the cheerleading effort.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, people should be held accountable for that. I mean, it's also much easier to have an effective army if you dehumanize. I mean, we've seen it in every war, right? If you dehumanize the subject population, it's much easier to carry out combat duties or operational tasks because you don't have any sort of empathy with the people that you're occupying, so you can do things that you would never do in normal life.
And the care available to people while they're in the military or after they leave is pretty chintzy, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean the Republican Party slashed it hugely, and I mean that's another the Republican Party as the party of the armed forces or salute our heroes type stuff is so contrary to reality. It's amazing that it's still believed on a wide basis. I mean, the Bush administration cut healthcare benefits for veterans literally continually throughout their 8 years. And Paul Ryan, his fiscal year 2011 budget, which was crazy enough, it completely eliminated the one program that exists for homeless veterans. Completely. Not cut by 50%, but completely. So homeless veterans would have no recourse to any kind of federal program to house themselves. So, and you see that pattern all the way through. To the Republican Party, I mean, the Democrats are guilty too, but there is a tangible difference between them. They're not doing the same sort of huge cuts. To the Republican Party, definitely, the veteran community is refuse. I mean, they're complete. They don't feel like they have any obligation to them. They're seen as some, the 47% victims that Romney talked about. They're in that group.
My God. Now, of course, the war in Iraq winding down, and I suppose the war in Afghanistan slated to wind down someday. Mm. So are the pressures quite the same as they were a few years ago?
I mean, no, they're not. But I mean, I get asked this question a lot. What does it mean that the financial... Well, you have the financial crisis as well, which has made a lot of people... put a lot of people out of work, so they're looking for any institution to make money, so the military becomes obviously more attractive. But the point is that the military has shown that it will lose its moral compass in a second. So presented with another war to fight, I mean, you have Iran, although there probably wouldn't be a ground invasion, we don't know what is going to happen in the future in terms of Syria, Iran. So if there was, for any reason, another ground invasion, you would see the Pentagon do exactly the same thing again. And that's what people should be thinking about and putting pressure on the Pentagon to uphold, is to enforce regulations strictly and also stop changing them when they have chronic troop needs. And there should also be, I mean, personally, I believe that the most democratic like, democratic way to raise an army is through conscription, if it's done democratically. I mean, if you're going to fight a war, you should have a representative demographic of the domestic population fighting that war, not just the poor, not just the black community, not just Hispanics.
Now that I'm safely over draft age, I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, we talked a little bit about this, but the fact that we've got now neo-Nazis and gang members with military training and maybe some military arms that they stole, and a whole lot of damaged people who were further damaged by the war back in the streets of the U.S., this is a problem that's going to fester horribly for years to come.
Yeah, and I mean, I end the book with a comparison between what happened in Rome in the later years. There's a lot of scholarly debate about why Rome fell when it did. It had, from this unbelievably high position, it was a shell power within a century. And there's a lot of debate about why that happened. But one strain of thought, which is quite prominent, is the military explanation, i.e. the Roman military started letting in people that they hadn't previously allowed to serve. So domestic undesirables, conquered barbarians, which eventually became a process called barbarization. So you see quite a lot of parallel. I mean, now we know that the American decline is a vogue topic in academia and the media. And I mean, I raised the issue in a book. I haven't seen it written about anywhere else. But the degradation of the fighting force has, through history, often been a prelude to imperial decline. And I mean, what you're talking about, these people back in the U.S., that might be a function of it, because obviously it's going to degrade U.S. society as well.
And they're coming back to an economy that can't really absorb them.
So, I mean, and you're seeing, I don't know if you saw recently, but the so-called anarchist militia, it had nothing to do with anarchism, but there was sort of there were white supremacist elements to it, but anyway, they wanted to assassinate, this was at Fort Stewart in Georgia, they had this militia had a plan to assassinate Obama and poison, I think it was the apples of Washington.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And that was, and the guy, even the ringleader of that militia got into the military on a moral waiver. So definitely the results of this are no way over. We're going to see this happening continually over the next 10, 20 years. And I'm sure every time something like this happens, I'll probably get a call from some journalist, because this hasn't been written about by the US media. It's kind of a crazy blind spot. I mean, the article I wrote about the neo-Nazis in the US military for Salon in 2009 was the first piece in the media that had even approached the topic. Maybe people will start getting interested more in it now, because it's going to affect the US population rather than the Iraqi and Afghani population, but we'll see.
That was Matt Kennard, author of Irregular Army: How the U.S. Military Recruited Neo-Nazis, Gang Members, and Criminals to Fight the War on Terror, from Verso. It's a featured premium on today's edition of Behind the News. You'll be able to get it for a pledge of $100 to KPFA.